sigh or anything, because it's just me sitting here. It's just me. I'm lonely. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is Make Me Smart, the show about tech and the economy and culture and all of that good stuff. Molly is out this week along with a whole lot of the Marketplace staff. Molly had a conference she had to go at. Everybody else gets vacation. So it's just me and you, because none of us is as smart as all of us, as we like to say around here. All right, so today we're going to do a little bit of the R word, recession. There has been a lot of talk about it lately, talk that got more heated this past Friday, if you were paying attention. Big meeting of central bankers out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The Kansas City Fed puts on a conference there every year. Everybody who's anybody in central banking goes. There was also some tariff back and forth between China and President Trump. And there was that whole "he hereby orders American companies out of China" thing. And so by the end of the day on Friday, things were topsy-turvy. The Dow was off more than 600 points. The major indices like 2.5-3% across the board. And that was before the G7 meeting this past weekend, at which there was all kinds of backing and forthing. There was a rebound in the markets, maybe sort of, kind of, some possibility of more trade talks. The president said China had called, but we don't really know about that. The yield curve has inverted again. Remember that? The global economy is still slowing. So now what, recession-wise? Here's what we're going to do. We got on Friday Neil Irwin from The New York Times back on the phone. He's a senior economics correspondent there, longtime friend of the pod. And he and I had a chat. And the caveat, of course, is that this was Friday. So it was right as Fed Chairman Jay Powell was speaking in Jackson Hole. It was before the G7. It was before the craziness. But it's some really good context, I think. Neil is super smart. So here you go. Neil Irwin from The New York Times. So, Neil, listen, let me start with a question that I get all the time. I'm sure you do, too. When's the recession going to start?
Maybe never. Maybe maybe we're already in one. That's the thing about recessions. You don't know in real time with any great certainty that you're in a recession. It takes time for data to come in. All we can do are look at signals. And so, for example, back in 2007, we entered a recession, December 2007, as late as the summer of 2008, mm-hmm. 6 months into this horrible, horrible recession. There was still a live debate whether it was a recession or not. That's, the reality. Until all the data's in, it's hard to say something definitive. I doubt we're in one right now, but we could easily be in one in a few months.
So if you're a consumer in this economy, should you just go on about your merry way? You know, don't check your 401k all the time and continue to put money aside and, shop within your means, all that stuff?
I mean, all that's true, but I think that's true whether times are good or bad or in between. Not checking your 401k every day or every week is good just because, you need to have a long-term view and not be, inclined to make a bad decision by selling the minute there's one little dip in the market. Spending within your means, only taking on debt responsibly, those are things that are true if you think a recession's coming. They're true if you think the economy's booming. So I think trying to make radical changes in your own life as a consumer because of headlines you see on the news about a possible recession, it's probably a bad idea.
Always good advice. But for those who want to be aware, what are the signs? What are you, as a trained observer of this economy, looking for?
So, look, what everybody's reacting to right now is what's happened in financial markets in the last few weeks. And that's important, and that can send important signals. But it's what ultimately matters is not what happens in the bond market or the stock market. What matters is what happens in the real economy. And for that, we look at different types of data. There are some forms of data that are better than others in terms of giving you a real-time temperature of what's happening. Every week, the Labor Department puts out the number of people who filed claims for unemployment insurance. Those numbers have been very low in recent months and years. If that starts to tick up, that's a sign that things are going south. There's all these surveys of different industries that come out in almost real time telling you what's happening with that industry, manufacturing, services. Monitoring those is really useful. I think those signals so far they look fine. They look like the economy's still growing and we're not in a recession. But if that starts to turn, that's when you need to worry.
All right. So if we're so strong here in this economy, what's the big worry then?
Well, the worry is the world is slowing down. China's slowing down. Europe is slowing down. There's a lot of geopolitical risk, and with Brexit, with the Italian government, with tensions with Hong Kong. And the risk is that the entire global trade system is shutting down in a way that will ultimately really damage the U.S. economy. American exporters might have less demand for their goods. Financial markets might freeze up and make capital less freely available. That could eventually leak into consumers and business investment. Ultimately, if businesses aren't hiring, if they're not giving people raises, the consumer economy economy could falter as well. So that's what's hanging over the world economy. What we don't know is, look, we know the United States is not an island in the world economy. The question is, how protected is it, though? And we're about to find that out.
A word here about the self-inflicted wound of the trade wars. How much damage do you think that's doing?
Look, it's the start of this story. It's the core of this story. Part of what's happening, and the reason the Chinese economy is slowing down a lot, the other Asian economies as well, is that this trade war has essentially thrown a bomb in the system of international commerce that is really the bedrock of our world economic system. And what the president's doing, what the Trump strategy is to keep escalating, to keep pushing at different things. It hasn't really been to solve things or resolve tensions. It's kind of throwing a wrench in different arrangements that have existed for a long time. You know, it's not so much the tariffs themselves that are risking the economy. It's the it's what the tariffs do to kind of disrupt global trade patterns and the confidence businesses have to invest and plan for the future.
All right. So let's say push comes to shove. A recession does start. It's not cataclysmic, but it's an economic downturn, and those can be painful. What are our options? What can be done?
Well, that's what's a little nerve-wracking about this. You know, if you think back to 2001, there was the dot-com crash, there was a freeze-up in business spending. That has some similarities to what might happen here. Now, that was a mild recession. In fact, if the 9/11 terrorist attacks hadn't happened, that probably wouldn't have been classified a recession at all. We could have a mild recession this time if it happens. This is similar in that we're talking about a kind of business pullback, and so the origins are similar. The difference is, back in 2001, the federal funds rate, which is the rate the Federal Reserve targets, was 6%. They had all this room to cut interest rates and stimulate activity. The deficit, there was actually a surplus at the time. The deficit was able to, the federal government could cut taxes and raise the deficit without much worry about the deficit rising. Right now, we're in a very different moment. We're at, you know, the Fed's interest rate target is only 2%, a little over that. So they don't have much room to cut interest rates. We're already running very large deficits. I think there'll be a lot of wariness on Capitol Hill about expanding deficits further, given that we're looking at trillion-dollar deficits. So, you know, the risk is that a small downturn becomes a worse downturn because the usual policy tools are not in great position to deal with it.
How big, I'm going to get a tad weedy here. We got last week the minutes of the July meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, in which it became clear, the meeting at which they cut interest rates for the first time in a decade, and in which it became clear that the Fed is kind of divided on what to do. How much does that complicate Chair Jay Powell's job going forward? You know, I mean, he gave this big speech in Jackson Hole talking about, you know, his challenge and what he can do. How complicated is his life right now?
It's pretty darn complicated. So on the one hand, he has President Trump berating him on Twitter seemingly every day. There was a really aggressive tweet from the president right after Powell's speech on Friday. But at the same time, he has to manage his committee, and you know, he does not make interest rate decisions on his own. He has this, it's called the Federal Open Market Committee, as you say, has about 19 people on it when it's fully staffed. It involves not just the governors in Washington, it involves presidents of reserve banks around the country. And what we've seen is those reserve bank presidents who are not appointed by the president, they're more hawkish. They're more reluctant to cut interest rates in the absence of really clear evidence that the economy is going south. Powell himself seems to be comfortable with making these adjustments, lowering rates based on kind of the forecast, what he expects to happen in the future. But it's clear he has a delicate task of trying to guide this committee with lots of different opinions, lots of different ways of viewing the world toward a decision, even assuming they do want to cut rates more.
I don't want to delve too much into the mind of President Trump because that can be perilous, but how damaging is it that he is always attacking the Fed?
I mean, look, I think they've now kind of gotten used to it. I mean, this is unprecedented in modern history. We've never seen anything like this. A president, you know, hammering his own appointee over and over with you know, very aggressive language. They don't like it at the Fed. You know, nobody likes to have the president of the United States, you know, calling them out all the time. I think they believe the right approach is to put their head down, look at the economics, try and make sound decisions for the U.S. economy. And in that speech in Jackson Hole, Chair Powell really did throw a little bit of a lob at the president's direction. He made clear that he does not believe the Fed can solve a breakdown in the international trade system. That's not their job. What they can do is deal with some of the economic fallout if that were to happen, lower rates. But, you know, there's a bit of a message that you can't blow up the international trade system, have all the economic distress that might cause and expect the Fed to clean up the mess. All they can do is try and cushion the blow.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Neil. A lot of people listening to this will remember only the Great Recession as what a recession is like. I think it's important to point out that that was kind of a one-off.
It was. That was a very severe recession. 10% unemployment at the peak. It took years and years to climb out of it. Even after the recession technically ended in mid-2009, it took years before things started to feel normal again. That's not how it always is. A 2001 recession, 1991 recession, those were damaging. And look, recessions are bad. We don't want one to happen. They cause higher unemployment. People lose their houses. Lots of bad stuff happens. But they're not all as bad as what happened in 2008.
Neil Irwin writes on the economy for the New York Times. He writes books, too, the most recent one of which you can hear on Marketplace, by the way, is called How to Win. Neil, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. So, look, with that as background, send us your thoughts, would you, about honestly, where you think this thing is going? Because it's often the case that people see a recession before economic indicators do. A lot of the indicators we get are lagging indicators, like jobs numbers that come out first Friday of every month. They actually look back. They don't look forward. The GDP report looks back. It doesn't look forward. So tell us what you're seeing out there and whether you feel, how you feel, maybe, about the possibility of another recession. And let me be clear here, shall we, for like 2 seconds. I'm not saying a recession's coming tomorrow. I'm not saying it's coming in a year. But there are some signs, and we need to be vigilant, and we need to do our due diligence about what that means. So hit us up. Send us a voice memo. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org, and we'll get it on the pod. Be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
There it is, the sigh. I didn't even plan that. All right, so look, we're gonna pass on the news this week because really nobody wants to hear me just opine about things that are on my mind because that's a whole different kind of podcast, which maybe we ought to do. I don't know. But we'll get right to you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Yes, exactly. I love that so much every time I hear it. So about last week, we talked streaming and Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and Disney and Apple and Comcast and all of those folks about what the what with that whole new market of what we see on our devices and on our TVs. And we specifically asked y'all if any of you are excited about what's out there in streaming land. Leah Lewis sent us this.
I am all for cord cutting since the advent of Roku. Fortunately for me, my mom is 93 years old, and unfortunately for me, we have Comcast. My mom is the cable TV watcher. I stream my choices. For myself, I don't spend much money on my streaming services. However, I waste my money on Comcast.
Well, look, I don't know if it's a waste of money if it makes your mom happy, right? That's the point. But look, this is the thing a lot of people are trying to think about, whether they cut the cord or stay with that old reliable, you know what you're getting, Comcast cable bundle. I mean, it's really interesting. Here's Evan Kaminsky. He sent us this voice memo about the streaming wars, as it were, and what he thinks of that.
I've recently entered the cord cutter lifestyle and find that divide and conquer is the best way to have access to all the exclusive shows. My friends and I each subscribe to a separate service, such as ESPN Plus or HBO, and share our logins. This way, no one person has to break the bank as we enter a phase when every media company seems to have its own service.
I truly don't understand why those streaming companies, and we had a conversation about this in a meeting that we had, like, what, Shara, a month or two ago? You and Tony and the whole sharing the passwords thing, right? Look at this. I'm talking through the glass. I'm talking to the producer. Because it's lonely in here. We actually had a meeting about a conversation about this in a meeting about sharing passwords and all of that stuff. And I honestly don't understand why they don't crack down, because everybody's doing it. I mean, truly. Who knows? Anyway, John Thornton sent us his voice memo from a small town in southeast Kansas. He writes, no internet or cable at home, so no streaming services, but he does listen to this podcast. Thank you very much. And here with some predictions on who might win the streaming wars.
I do follow a lot of the market, and I thought Disney will be a big upset in the market of streaming because of the fact that they are such a big content producer. And now that they own Fox, they produce a lot larger amount of content.
I believe that to be correct. I forget what Molly said about this last week, but I think she's on board with that one as well, right? That Disney is going to be the 800-pound gorilla in this thing? I don't know. We'll ask her. Maybe she'll send us a voice memo. No, I'm just kidding. She's back next week, by the way. So we also got the streaming wars into the Make Me Smart question, which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Jose Gomez sent us this answer.
I thought that I wanted the ability to pay for individual channels and only pay for those channels that I watch. Turns out that I was wrong. I miss cable. I used to pay $189 for my cable bundle with internet, which included every channel I watched. Now I pay for internet by itself, $70, $16 for Netflix, $10 for Amazon Prime, $50 for YouTube TV, $20 for Philo TV, $12 for Hulu Plus, and I'm about to pay $13 for Disney Plus. I can never find anything that I'm looking for because everything is spread across all these services, which is a giant nightmare. I miss cable.
So I totally hear that. I totally hear that. And there's a little bit of, hey, you kids, get off my lawn in this. But let us very quickly add up these numbers, right? 70, I'm going to round it, right? 70 plus 16 is 85, plus 10 is 95, plus 50 is 145, plus that's 165, plus 12 is 77, plus 30, 100. Like, it's almost $200 that Jose is paying. And that, frankly, is bananas. There's going to have to be some disruption of this already disrupted market. That's what I think. Because those price points, I mean, come on, $200? It's crazy. Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Voice memo comes to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, by the way, bonus content, the Make Me Smart newsletter, comes to you every Friday. It's marketplace.org/newsletters. You can sign up there. It's all lonely, man. It's all lonely. It's been like me rambling, and there's no byplay between the hosts. All right, Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostat. Thanks also to Christian Buckler, who helped out in our DC Bureau. The theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager of this whole production house is Deborah Clark. Molly is back next week, so this podcast will be better. That's all I have to say. I'm just going to let the music play. There we go. $200 for cable, by the way. I mean, for all those streaming services for that guy. Forget it. It's banana. Also, this music is very long. Don't we have a short version of this music? I'm just saying. Not that I don't like the music.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.